I'm just going to briefly introduce Professor Mohanbir Sahni, the McCormick Tribune Professor of Technology and Director of the Center for Research, Technology and Innovation at the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. Professor Sahni is a globally recognized scholar, teacher, consultant, and speaker in strategic marketing, e-business, and innovation. His research and teaching interests include collaborative marketing with customers. He has been widely recognized as a thought leader. Business Week named him as one of the 25 most influential people in e-business. And with that, I would request Professor Sahni to come up and share his thoughts with us.
Good afternoon, everybody. What Mangalam was also saying is that I didn't get the presentation to her till the last minute, which is endemic to academics. This is what we do. We think at the last minute. But it's a pleasure to be in Boston, and it's a pleasure to be with all of you. And I thought what I'd do is to share perspectives on, since this is about innovation in a flat world is the theme of the conference, I thought that I would talk to you about innovation, but innovation in an open world, which is sort of what Friedman is saying when he's saying the world is flat. And it's a phenomenon that I have become increasingly interested in, and I think is really going to reshape the way new products, new offerings are brought to market by really harnessing the power of the community. If it's one thing that I've been totally amazed at, it is the wisdom of us, the wisdom of the community, and the power of the network to amplify innovation reach, innovation speed, and the quality of innovation outcomes. So what I want to share with you are perspectives on network-centric innovation, which is really using the power of the network by firms to achieve new levels of productivity and innovation. So here's the basic idea, that as we look around us, the word network-centric is starting to appear in a lot of contexts. I think the first ones to talk about it in 1987 was Sun Microsystems, when they talked about the network is the computer. And more recently, we've begun to see this whole notion of network-centric computing. In fact, now we start to think about network-centric applications. The whole thesis behind Web 2.0 is that the network has become the platform, and all applications, all content, all data will reside on the network. So that's a very different way to think about software, to think about applications, to think about how computing works. So that's network-centric computing. We've also started to, in a very different domain, if you look at what Boeing is trying to do in the defense world, they have a concept that they call network-centric warfare. And network-centric warfare is the idea that all weapon systems become nodes on a network, and this weapon systems network is optimized in real time to work jointly together, which, by the way, the defense has never been able to do until recently. So similarly, there is a concept that I want to promote or talk about, and that is network-centric innovation. So what is the notion here? So let me define formally network-centric innovation as the idea of it's an externally focused approach to innovation that relies on external sources of knowledge and sources of wisdom in order to amplify the innovation outcomes. So that's the basic notion. It's searching outward, looking beyond the boundaries of the firm. And that's why I call this presentation Unbounded Creativity, which is really looking beyond the boundaries of the firm. So the question is, why do we need to look beyond the boundaries of the firm? This is for two or three reasons. The first important reason is Bill Joy, the chief scientist at Sun, once said, this is Joy's law. He said, the smartest people don't work for you. You know, they're outside your company. And if that be the case, then you really need to search and leverage the wisdom that resides outside your company. So one is to look beyond the boundaries of the firm. The second thing is that you need to look beyond the boundaries of geography. I think one of the things that we've noticed lately is the fact that talent is global. And the 2.5 billion people who live in China and India are now getting connected to the grid, and we're able to tap into that talent pool, which is leading to really some very, very interesting outcomes from an innovation standpoint. But the third problem that companies have generally is that they are limited by the markets that they serve and the customers that they talk to. In fact, this is the essence of Christensen's point, that if you're really customer-focused, you can be led blind by the tyranny of the served market, because it's hard for you to look beyond your immediate field of view in terms of your market. So for all of these reasons, I think the network is becoming a very important source for ideas, for innovation. So let me take you through a couple of case studies to just illustrate this concept of how the network can amplify innovation. So this is a company called Innocentive. They're actually based in the Boston area. They are a spin-off from Eli Lilly. Here's the idea. Eli Lilly is a pharmaceutical company, and some 5 years ago, they had the radical notion of, why don't we take our R&D problems that we can't solve and put them up on the internet? Now you can see the lawyers having a heart attack. You know, you're going to do what? You know, but they did that. And the idea was actually very elegant, that anybody, any scientist around the world can come in and try to solve these unsolved problems for a fee, for a bounty. It's essentially a marketplace for talent, for ideas. And Innocentive today has grown into a phenomenal R&D marketplace, a marketplace that connects seekers who are companies looking to have their R&D problems solved with solvers. And solvers are scientists who are working on these problems. And just to illustrate the notion of reach, let me share some numbers with you. Eli Lilly had started this Innocentive in the area of small molecule synthetic chemistry. Now, of those scientists, they had about 250 scientists on staff. In the entire U.S. pharmaceutical industry, it's estimated that there are about 5,000 of these PhDs working on these sorts of problems. But the worldwide population of these scientists is estimated to be 1 million. Today, when I last spoke with Innocentive about 6 months ago, they had about 70,000 scientists solving problems. 250, 70,000. That's the scalability you get in terms of the reach. And at what cost? Nothing. This is contingent labor. Unless they solve a problem, they don't get paid. So imagine having suddenly the access to 50 or 60,000 scientists, brains from, by the way, 175 countries who are solving problems for you, and they only get paid when they solve a problem. So this is an example of the power of the network to reach out in the case of scientific endeavor. And by the way, now Innocentive has about 37 other companies that participate and post their problems, including Procter & Gamble, BASF, Dow Chemical, and so on. Let's look at another example of network-centric innovation, Procter & Gamble. Now, P&G has been recently rated as the most innovative company by Fortune magazine. And one of the things that they have become very sort of popular and famous about in recent years is this notion that they call C plus D, which is connect plus develop. We know about R&D. But the notion that P&G has is they realize, and when I spoke to their head of external business development, he said, we're a $70 billion company. To grow at 8% a year, we need to create the world's fifth largest consumer packaged goods company every year. And there's just no way we can do that by ourselves. So we need to reach out, and we need to get beyond the NIH, the not invented here syndrome, and we need to source our innovation externally. So they actually have a specific website called Connect Plus Develop where they source ideas. And they have built a very sophisticated network of innovation around themselves. They reach out to individual inventors. They reach out to R&D marketplaces like Innocentive that I just told you about, as well as others like Yet to Be or Nine Sigma. They reach out to communities of practice. They reach out to academic institutions. And they are really starting to amplify the innovation outcomes at Procter & Gamble through reaching externally. And Lafley has publicly announced that P&G is going to source from 20% of their innovative ideas coming from outside up to 50% over the next couple of years. So these are just some examples to get your thinking going on the power of the network, either to increase reach or speed. And let's look at a case study from Procter & Gamble. Some of your children probably have this toothbrush at home, the Crest Spin Brush. The Crest Spin Brush was not created by P&G. It was created by four inventors and entrepreneurs from Cleveland. It was acquired by Procter & Gamble. And within a few years, it is now a $300 million brand. And it has made Crest into Procter's newest billion-dollar brand. And all this is because these entrepreneurs are better at coming up with ideas, and P&G has no guilt and no shame in now connecting to these people, bringing them inside, and leveraging. By the way, for those of you, I know Ty focuses on entrepreneurs. For the entrepreneurs in the audience, one piece of advice now is reach out to these big companies, because there is a very interesting model now of entrepreneurs and inventors really getting connected to the Proctors of the world, and it is being mediated by a new kind of entity that I've recently begun to study, and I call them innovation capitalists. Innovation capitalists are people who connect individual and entrepreneurs and inventors to big companies like P&G. They serve as a mediating role, and it's not just a brokerage role, but what they will do is they will go to the inventor, work with them, and actually develop and refine the idea, do some market testing, do some validation, and get it market ready for the P&Gs of the world. The value proposition to Procter is that they don't have to search for needles in haystacks, and they also don't get ideas before they're too early, too half-baked. The value proposition for the inventor is that the inventors find a good way to enter into large companies. So there are some interesting new mediation mechanisms that are also being created to facilitate transactions like this. As an interesting aside, the spin brush originally was a lollipop. You know, it was a spinning lollipop. So I have a suggestion for Procter. They can make a double-headed product, create plaque on one side and remove plaque on the other side. You know? So now I'm an academic, so I wouldn't be doing my job justice if I didn't talk philosophically about what's going on here. So if we take a minute to talk a little bit about transaction cost theory and economics, the idea here is that generally there are two modes of production that we understand. One mode of production is the market. The market is a place where we go and buy things. So innovation can be bought. Cisco is an example of a company that buys innovation. So the other approach is the hierarchy. The hierarchy is when things are done inside the company. Okay, so managerial coordination becomes the mechanism of governance, as opposed to a marketplace where the mechanism of governance really is the pricing and contracting mechanism. So there is a third method of production that we are starting to see, and this is absolutely fascinating. This is the idea of commons-based peer production, community-based production, because a community is neither a market nor is it a hierarchy. As this diagram illustrates, this is from an article I'd written about 6 years ago where we talked called Communities of Creation. So the notion here is that if a hierarchy is too structured, too rigid, too bureaucratic, and too inward-looking, a market is too chaotic, too serendipitous. So in between, there is a notion of a community, which is a semi-permeable membrane almost, if you remember your biology. And the idea here is that it's a gated community. And this gated community has certain rules for participation, some central coordinator, and some mechanisms for allocating intellectual property rights and value appropriation by the participants. So this is, for example, how Linux works. The community of open source, there is an organizing framework, but it's a loose community. It is neither open nor closed. And some of the really interesting things that we start to think about are innovative ways in which value is captured and how money is made in these communities. And everything we know about intellectual property really gets questioned. I remember speaking to the CEO of Red Hat, Bob Young, when I was doing some consulting work with them. This is 1998. I said, Bob, what is your business model? He says, well, in the software business, we sell software and give away T-shirts. He says, we give away software and sell T-shirts. You know, and so interestingly, Red Hat doesn't own the intellectual property, the products that it sells. But it still makes a very good living. But the value capture mechanisms are very indirect. Similarly, you might ask the question, why would individual programmers spend so much time and effort writing open source code for which they get no economic reward? But there are other mechanisms of reward, monetizing reputation, recognition from the peer group. Why do people write 2,800 book reviews on Amazon? Right? There was a woman they interviewed, and she said, I like to help people. My response is, get a life, lady.
you know. But you know what? If she wants to help people, what you do as Amazon is you create a currency. The currency you create is top 10 reviewer, top 100 reviewer. That's a currency. And if she can monetize that and get social recognition, that's money in the bank for her. So that's really what you need to think about. If you are in a company, think about your customers. Think about how much wisdom and how much expertise and how much knowledge is existing in your customer base. Forget about customer knowledge management being what do we know about customers. But think about customer knowledge management being how do we manage the knowledge that customers have. Because there's a lot of wisdom that they have. We need to find platforms for creating that dialogue, and we need to find mechanisms for rewarding them for participation. So instead of thinking about ROI, think about ROP, you know, return on participation. Why should customers participate? In the case of Innocentive, it's an economic reward, but there are many other forms of rewards that we need to think about. So the differences in network-centric innovation, and I really think this is a new way of thinking about innovation, is it is fundamentally open, it is fundamentally community-based, it's about openness instead of opaqueness, and it's not about control, it's about democratization of information. And it is something that large corporations traditionally are fundamentally uncomfortable with. By the way, this is starting to happen not only to innovation in terms of product development. This is happening in terms of innovation in terms of creating advertising. I met a fascinating company in the Silicon Valley recently called Current TV. Current TV is reverse TV. Programming is created by the people, just like YouTube and so on. So the notion there is that customers are creating this content. They are innovating in terms of the types of content and types of programming that should be put on board. But what you want to do is to create a mechanism for them to be able to monetize their reputation. So where did open innovation start? It all started with open source software. And open source software is a mechanism for software production that relies on peer contributions and peer review. Peer review is very, very important in this context, right? So it's a decentralized production mechanisms, and the commons becomes the basis for production. And R&D is not done inside the firm, but R&D is done in a community, and that community is orchestrated by some sort of community organizer. In the case of Linux, it was Linus Torvalds, but I'm also starting to see some very interesting hybrid forms. For example, if you consider a company like MySQL, they're in the open source database company. They actually don't produce MySQL using the open source method. They actually have proprietary, they own the intellectual property over MySQL. But what they realize is that 70% of the effort in software development is in debugging and testing. They open out the debugging and testing to the community. And the community improves upon it. The community writes extensions. The community finds bugs. And they in turn can use extensions of the product in their own work. So I'm starting to see lots of interesting hybrids. And what I'm also starting to see is that the community-based production, as in Linux, is taking on more and more the characteristics of a hierarchy. And hierarchies, as in Procter & Gamble, are becoming more and more towards going like a marketplace. So this market and hierarchies are converging into this whole domain of commons-based production that we call community-based production. So this is not happening only in the context of open source software. There are a number of domains where you started to see collaborative, peer-based production, community-based innovation becoming really interesting, whether it is in biology, whether it is in publishing. You know, the biggest encyclopedia on the planet today is Wikipedia. And what is Wikipedia? It's nothing but a collaborative encyclopedia created, managed, and governed by the community. Now, you might ask, you know, how does the community police itself? People can put all sorts of wrong information into Wikipedia. But one thing we've learned is community policing is a very robust idea. The community has an interest in making sure that the community asset is not depreciated. That's also, by the way, what prevents forking in open source software, which means the development of multiple code bases and multiple variants of Linux. It's not going to happen because it's not in everybody's interest. So splinter groups are brought back. And it sustains. So this is starting to happen. You saw what Howard Dean did in politics, now, despite what the outcome was, but the moveon.org and the notion that every constituent could become an organizer and create their own community around themselves is a very, very powerful idea. The open source cookbook, I like the open source book. It's called Nothing So Strange. It's about Bill Gates' assassination. and you can download it, and you can modify it, you can create a new ending, and then you can post your work back to the website. So this is the open source movie. Police work, you know, people can come together to solve criminal cases that have never been solved. In engineering, you know, in astronomy, it turns out that amateur astronomers are finding comets and asteroids before NASA and before all the, you know, science labs can, because the data is being sent out to the community and they can search and look, you know, in a distributed way much, much faster than the labs can on their own because they have limited manpower. The SETI project is another example, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I have hard enough time finding intelligence here, you know, so our politicians and so on, you know. Maybe we look in Mars, we'll find some intelligent politicians. But anyway, and one of the sort of, and I teach at a business school, and I've suggested the following idea to IBM. Let's see if they bite. This is the open source curriculum project. They said, we don't like the way strategy is taught in business schools. I said, fine, here's what we're going to do. At Kellogg, we will orchestrate a community of editors. We'll divide the strategy domain into a number of subject areas, and each of those we'll give out as a subject area. That's how journals are written. And each of these academics will be responsible for maintaining a particular content area. What is this? Nothing but the Wikipedia for strategy curriculum. And then all the resources that are created there, case studies, articles, and so on, will be open source. And instead of every business school creating its own strategy content, why don't we create a community-based content that's free to everybody? It'll also blow a hole in the Harvard Business School's revenue, which is great. And MIT is starting to basically put all of its content online, but that's not what I'm talking about. MIT is doing sharing. I'm talking about collaborative creation of a strategy curriculum, of a marketing curriculum, you know, and I think that would be phenomenally more robust than what any individual business school could do. But you know what? It requires a change in mindset. What? Me collaborate with Wharton or me collaborate with Harvard? They're my competitors. I think the whole notion of collaborating to compete is going to be something we have to become comfortable with. And also collaborating with customers. And also becoming more open. And also letting go of your intellectual property. Losing some control. It's okay. You know, as Eric Segal said, if you really love something, you gotta let it go. So, he went on to say, if it comes back to you, you know, that's good. If it doesn't, it never was yours. So, open source beer, I like that, you know. You can go there and you can have your own beer recipe. I know we have Rajiv from Sula Vineyards. Maybe he'll put his wine recipes online, and so on. So this idea of community-based creation, I think, transcends. It's coming from software. By the way, look at the Human Genome Project. Finished years ahead of schedule. Why? Because the results were shared and the community worked together to solve these problems. So I think this is a very, very generalizable idea. However, it doesn't work in all contexts. There is a very important construct I want to share with you, and that is the notion of the architecture of participation. And the notion there is you have to design your products and your projects ahead of time so that they're modular, so that they're decomposable, so that you can have individual contributors work on these in modules and then you can assemble stuff together and it still works. So the architecture of participation is the interesting notion that ahead of time, before you actually work on a project, design it to be decomposable. So you might actually architect it so that it becomes community-based and participatory. This is sort of like, you know, how vector processing works in the computer world, where you can take a problem and decompose it into millions of solved problems, then you can do massively parallel processing and put it together. Weather problems are like that. SETI is like that, because in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they put a grid, and every little piece of the sky is analyzed by a different computer, and it can be put together to see the joint results. So that's required. You also need a large community of participants that have shared goals and shared interests, as well as the mechanism of peer-based review should be something that the project should benefit from. So those are some of the characteristics that require these projects to be thought this way. So the interesting idea now is, for example, I believe the world of software will be transformed, as it already is, by the Googles of the world, because we will start to see this sort of notion. And the notion that we don't build large pieces of code called applications. We build a range of services, and these services are mashed up. Now you start to see interesting mashups. Google Maps combined with real estate equals Zillow.com. You know, an example of that where you start to see this, you know, in these modules or Lego block, building blocks of web services that can be put together to create some really interesting innovations. That may be the future of software, but for that you need to chunk it down, you need to break it down, and you need to have a lingua franca, you need to have a language for these modules to connect with each other, and that's what XML Web Services, Web 2.0, whatever the heck you want to call it, is all about. So that's really where I think that products and projects will get redesigned in order to permit this community-based collaboration. So as we look into the future and we look at the big picture, I think philosophically I find open innovation to be a very liberating idea because it is the idea that it returns power to the individual. It's a democratizing force. And if anything, we believe, you know, if you think about it, the internet's contribution to society is it is a democratizing force for information. All I'm saying now is it's a democratizing force for innovation. And that's really what open innovation is about. It pushes power to the edges. It democratizes the institution. And what it also will require is a radical thinking, a rethinking of IP regimes. Because the fundamental disconnect is that knowledge is social, but profits are proprietary. So how do we make sure that the stuff that we create in a community, who owns it? How do we make money? And I think what you'll have to do is to find other ways of making money. I tell my academic colleagues this too. If you go to my website, you know, mohansawhney.com, whatever I write, I put it up there. I said, take it. It's all open. Because that's, and my colleagues have a really hard time with this. They say, but that's my intellectual property. That's proprietary. And I said, if you believe that all the wisdom you had is contained in your PowerPoint slides, good luck. You know? So I want the stuff to be out there because that seeds the other revenue streams and how you really make money as an academic, I won't tell you. But let me say it's not from selling PowerPoint slides, you know, or selling books for that matter. But it is really about socializing knowledge. It comes back to you in different ways. So I think one of the really interesting open frontiers, and that's the projects that I'm pursuing currently, are what are the different mechanisms for value capture in this open innovation world? How do we make money at the individual level? How do we make money at the firm level? And what are these indirect forms of value capture that will sustain these ideas? Because the traditional notions that we have are quite limiting. So, I need to finish. Give me 1 minute. This is my PowerPoint time. I apologize. But the notion here that we need to think about, this is how this would have linked to Venkat's work had he been here. He had a family emergency, so he couldn't be here, is that you need to bring customers into the conversation to create collaboration with customers, to get this insight from customers. And that requires you to really think about platforms for communication as well as incentives that you want to create for customers. So that's really as well as sort of thinking about new metrics like return on participation. So that very quickly was a review of the survey of the landscape. But all in all, what I believe is that the old notion of R&D or innovation was we did skunk works, we went into a laboratory, and we came up with great stuff. I think now, with the facilitative role that the internet plays, we're entering into a new era of distributed, commons-based, peer-based, community-centric innovation. And this really has the power to transform companies and is already beginning to do so. So thank you very much for your attention.